Thank you. Thank you, Ivan. Thanks for doing that reading as well. So we're going to be looking this morning a little bit at some of the things that happened in the life of Jacob, culminating in some of what we read there in Genesis chapter 32. And when I originally started to put this talk together, it was kind of over Christmas, over New Year, and kind of thinking about, it's a time of year where people reflect. I mean, I suppose it still kind of is January, although we've probably moved on a little bit from that. We're back into the regular kind of routine of things now. But we do take that time, and we also do on a Sunday, don't we, to kind of reflect a little bit on where we are in our lives and where we are in our relationship with God and His Son. And what I thought we would do then is spend a few minutes thinking about Jacob, who was a man who had what might be called a kind of an up and down relationship with God. Sometimes it was in a good place, sometimes it was not in such a good place. I don't think there's any question that Jacob always believed in God. I don't think his faith ever, disappeared or anything like that. I think he was always somebody who had God in his life and God was important to him. But often you find that he was on the edge of Jacob's life rather than in the middle. Certainly practically in the outworking of Jacob's life, Jacob relied on himself for the most part. He relied on his own thinking, his own planning, his own cunning, his own skill, his own cleverness, and only cursorily, if you like, consulted God or thought of God. God was, in many times, was a kind of a small part of his thinking. Now, we find the story of Jacob, of course, in Genesis. And obviously, you know how the backstory of how he's a twin, isn't he? And he tricks his twin Esau into selling him the birthright. And he takes the blessing that really belonged to Esau. And similarly, to kind of consolidate that, he then tricks his own father, Isaac, deceives him into thinking that he is Esau, when in fact, obviously, he's the younger son, Jacob. And so we really get introduced to Jacob as this character who is quite happy to trick, deceive, do whatever's needed to kind of get his own way. And someone who's kind of, there's a lot of tension in his life. He's wrestling against people, he's wrestling against his father's will, he's wrestling against his brother, and that continues for a large part of his life. Okay. In fact, actually, that's his name, isn't it? That's what his name, Jacob, kind of means. It means one who supplants, one who replaces, tricks, deceives. That's kind of what his name means. So he is a character who is full of faults, by no means a perfect example of a follower of God, not by any means. But yet, despite that, God chooses him. He chooses him because of the promises that have been made to Abraham. But he chooses him because, I guess, he sees what Jacob could be. God sees what Jacob could be, what is there, the potential, I suppose, rather than the person he is at that particular moment in time. So God chooses this man, and then this man, obviously, as we know, becomes the ancestor of the Jewish nation and of Jesus himself, doesn't he? And in chapter 28 of Genesis, following the deception of his brother, following the deception of his father, and a little bit concerned, particularly about the reaction of his brother, he leaves his father's house down in the south of, I guess, what is now Israel, in the south, and he goes north up to modern-day Syria, somewhere like that, to spend time with his uncle Laban, away from Esau and the danger that is there. And he stays there for many years, and we know the stories of how he marries Leah and Rachel, the daughters of Laban, and how he starts a large family. We know the story of how he is a very successful shepherd working for Laban, grows his own as well as his uncle's flocks and riches and so on. And we also know how he himself, having been a trickster, is tricked himself, isn't he, several times by his uncle Laban. And almost that God is trying to teach Jacob a lesson through Laban about using trickery, deceit, and so on to get your own way in life. God is trying to help Jacob to be a better man, someone who's more aware of himself and what his faults are. But I don't want to kind of go into the details of his life with Laban in North. There were two meetings that I want to kind of concentrate on with angels that Jacob has. He has one right at the start of his journey. As he leaves Isaac and goes north, he has that famous vision of the ladder. We'll look at that in a moment. And then after his time with Laban, when he starts to come back down, he has another couple of encounters. He has one there at the start of Genesis 32 with the camp of God, the camp of angels. And then also he then wrestles with what many believe is an angel at the end of chapter 32. Okay. So the first one then is in Genesis chapter 28. So if you have a look at Genesis chapter 28. I'm going to go in at verse 10. So Genesis chapter 28, verse 10. Jacob left Beersheba, just headed down right in the south, and went towards Haran, which is right in the north. And he came to a certain place, and he stayed there that night because the sun had set. And that, for me, that phrase, the sun had set, is quite a key phrase. We'll pick up on that a little bit later. And he takes one of the stones in that place, puts it under his head, and lies down to sleep. And dreams, and behold, there was a ladder, or perhaps a stairway, something like that, set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and to your offspring. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west, and to the east, and to the north, and to the south. And in you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. I am with you, and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. So the kind of a very, very strong promise here that Jacob gets from God. This promise that God will be with him wherever he goes. He will stay with him, he will never leave him. And these promises that he's made about this inheritance are sure that they will definitely come to pass. So, although Jacob is leaving the house of his father, he's going into a foreign land, effectively. He has this promise going with him, this kind of sure hope that God will always be with him. And, you know, it's a very kind of strong promise. Jacob recognises that the Lord's in this place, and he names the place Bethel, doesn't he? And then in verse 20, Jacob made a vow saying, it's interesting this, that there was no if in what God had said. He said, I will be with you. It's almost kind of irrelevant of what Jacob was going to say or do. God would be with him anyway. But Jacob in response says if. So he says if, in verse 20, God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, then I will give, and will give me bread to eat and fall to earth, so that I come again to my father's house, then the Lord shall be my God. And this stone which I set up for a pillar shall be God's house, and I will give you a tenth of all that I have. So a couple of things to notice from that. As I said, first, notice that God says he will always be with Jacob regardless. There's no if, there's no conditions. By contrast, Jacob does seem to give a condition. It's kind of if God is with him, then he will, you know, he will be God's. And when we think about the ladder or the stairway, there's a gap, isn't there? What that is saying to me is that although God is with Jacob and is there to guide him, protect him, you know, be there, there is nevertheless a gap. There's a big gap, actually. There's this big ladder, this big stairway between them. But God uses the angels as a bridge between himself and Jacob. He kind of offers to Jacob where he is, which is a long way from where he should be. And then that verse 11, as I said, it says, this happened as the sun had set, i.e. as darkness has come on the land. And I think that's kind of a telling observation. I mean, it's obvious, I suppose, if he has a dream at night, it's going to be in the dark. But it's kind of telling us that just as he has physically moved away from Isaac, physically moved away from his father's house, he's also spiritually moving away as well. Although God has said he's going to be with him, the next few years of Jacob's life is one very much where he is away from God. He is away from the worship of God, he is away from the lifestyle, if you like, that he should be living, that he might have lived, if he had stayed in his father's house. He's entering a period, effectively, of darkness. The sun has set, if you like, on his life, and he's going into a period of darkness. And as he goes into this period of darkness, God gives him his vision, he's given his light, if you like, to keep him whilst he is in the darkness. So Jacob, he travels north, away from Isaac, to the house of Laban, and to this period of relative darkness in his life. But as we've seen, God stays with him, he cares for him, protects him even in this darkness. And after many years, it's time for Jacob to come back home, to come back south, leave his uncle behind and return to Isaac. And in that time, you know, if we were to spend time reading chapter 29, 30, 31, we would see that it's true that God has been and remains a part of Jacob's life, but it's on the edge of Jacob's life. It's not in the middle. And now is the time for God to move more to the centre of Jacob's life. Go to chapter 31. Genesis chapter 31. Verse 17. So Jacob arose, and he set his sons and his wives on camels, and he drove away all his livestock, all his property that he had gained, the livestock that was in his possession that he had acquired, to go to the land of Canaan to his father Isaac. Laban had gone out to shear his sheep, and they sneak away basically. Whilst Laban's back is turned, while he's occupied elsewhere, he flees and leaves quietly. Verse 21, he fled with all that he had and arose and he crossed the Euphrates and he set his face towards the hill country. So even now that Jacob's mind is turned back towards his father, we still see that he's trusting in his own planning, his own cleverness, his own strength. He's trying to outwit people, outthink people. So, you know, more than he's trusting God, he's trusting himself, isn't he, still? But it's not his own skill, his own planning, his own cleverness which protects it. Verse 28. Laban finds out and catches up with him. Verse 28. Why did you not permit me to kiss my sons and my daughters farewell? Now you have done foolishly. It is in my power to do you harm. But the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, be careful to say not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. So, for all Jacob's planning, it's actually God who has protected him here, and, if you like, stopped Laban from acting rashly. Laban could have reacted angrily in the moment, and God has turned his hand. So it's God who is the one who is actually protecting him, not his own planning or his own cleverness. Then we come to chapter 32. And the first meeting in chapter 32 with an angel, or with angels. So chapter 32, verse 1, this is after he departs from Laban. Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, this is God's camp. And so he called the name of that place, Machanaim, which basically means two camps. And I think that's a kind of a perfect illustration, really, of just exactly where Jacob is in his relationship with God. He's there, so the angels are there, near to the camp of Jacob, and God is there in Jacob's life, he's a part of it, and that's good. But they're not joined together, are they? It's not one camp, it's two camps, they're separate. God is in Jacob's life, but he's not in the centre of it, he's on the edge. There's still a separation between them, perhaps nearer than when there was a ladder between them, but still, nevertheless, they are apart. And I think this can be the case for many of us. Many of us who you know, we have a relationship with God. God is in our lives, you know. Our faith can be relatively strong. It's not necessarily that we, you know, we're struggling with our faith. I mean, we may be struggling with our faith, but it's not necessarily the case. We have God in our life, but he's on the edge. He's kind of at arm's length. So he's an influence to some extent, but he's not right in the centre of it. And I think that can be the case of many of us, not just Jacob. Verse 9. So Jacob now, his thoughts have turned away from worrying about Laban, and he's now worrying again about Esau. Is Esau still going to be angry after all these years? How is Esau going to react? He's afraid. Okay, so what does he do? Verse 9, it sounds like he's doing the good thing here. Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, return to your country and to your kindred, that I may do you good. He's remembered the promises, hasn't he? I am not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. So he's humble before God, kind of make himself vulnerable before God. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. Please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he may come and attack me, the mothers with the children. But you said, I will surely do you good, and may your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitudes. So it sounds like he's putting himself at God's mercy, you know, putting his trust in God, asking God for guidance and for deliverance. But it's not quite what he's doing. This is just a part of his plan. Because in verse 3, come back to verse 3, Jacob had sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land, to kind of give Esau a good story about Jacob, and to plead with him for lenience. Also verse 6, the messengers returned to Jacob saying, we came to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you, there are 400 men with him. And Jacob was greatly afraid. And so he divides the people who were with him and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two camps, thinking if Esau comes to one camp and attacks it, then the camp that is left will escape. So he's planning, isn't he? He's thinking, He's thinking he needs to take measures. He, just as he did with Laban when it didn't work, he's doing something similar here with Esau, isn't he? He's relying on God to some extent, but he's also relying on his own cleverness to solve the problem. Then we come to the incident then where he wrestles with an angel. Verse 22. The same night he arose and took his two wives, his two female servants and his 11 children, and he crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream and everything else that he had, and he was left alone. So he sends everything ahead across the stream, and he stays behind alone. Perhaps it's to think and reflect, perhaps it's to pray. It's not entirely sure what he does when he's on his own. And we read that a man visits him when he's on his own, and they wrestle all through the night. And another place in the Bible, kind of later on, is one of the prophets. It suggests that this was actually an angel of God, not a human being. And actually, in verse 30 here, Jacob himself recognises after this night of wrestling that he has seen God face to face. So there's something this man that he wrestles with which isn't normal. Clearly not a normal human being, but somebody from God. And in terms of this wrestling, I guess people's views on it are divided. I mean, some people think that this was a literal physical wrestling that happened all night. Other people think that actually this was more of a vision, a dream that Jacob had, that God gave to him. And, you know, I think it could be either of these things. It doesn't say clearly that it's a dream or a vision, you know, as it does for the vision that he had in Genesis chapter 28. But I lean towards it being a vision or a dream, kind of because it acts as a mirror in many ways to the dream that he had. So as he goes up into the land, he has this vision from God, and then he comes out of the land, he has this vision from God. One on the way as he leaves Isaac, and one as he returns to Isaac. And also, remember that I said, at the start of the first vision, it says, and the sun had set. Then at the end of this vision, if that's what it is, in verse 31, it says the sun rose. So it kind of almost like it's a bookend to this period of Jacob's life. He goes down into this period of darkness, and then at the end of it, he comes out of darkness as he makes his way back to Isaac. The sun rises. He's moving out of spiritual darkness and back into the light. Verse 28, during this wrestling then, the man says to Jacob, your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. God changes Jacob's name to Israel, and I think that's kind of to match the change which has been happening inside Jacob, so to speak. His name matches what's been going on. But he says he's been successful in his wrestling, it seems to suggest, doesn't it? He's won a victory. And this name kind of commemorates that. But what is the kind of the tangible result, effectively, of this wrestling? What's the tangible result of his victory? Well, it's an injury, isn't it? He's been injured in the course of this wrestling. He's been made permanently weak. He will limp for the rest of his life. So, if it is a victory, and God said it's a victory, it's a victory of weakness, isn't it? God has kept his promises to Jacob, as he said he would do, but Jacob hasn't, it's not a passive thing. Jacob hasn't come out of it unchanged. He's been changed by God working with him. And whenever in the future that Jacob is tempted to kind of rely on his own cleverness, go his own way, he's going to be reminded, isn't he, by this limp that he has. It's a permanent reminder that only in weakness and only in laying himself out vulnerable before God that he has real strength. Only when he's put his trust in God and not in himself does he really have a true victory. And for ourselves, well, I think that reminds us that it's only in our weakness that we have real strength and victory. And it's only when we allow ourselves to be led by God, put him at the centre of our lives, not on the edge, not just rely on our own ability and strength, that we can have true victory. You know, and Jacob's life reminds us as well that, you know, God's always there. He's always with us in his life. He always keeps his promises to us. But we're changed by that process. In the way that God keeps his promises to us, it's not a passive thing for us. It's something which results in us being changed, and that change can be uncomfortable. Now, just before we finish, I just want to think briefly, as we come to think of the emblems, of another story, one that happened at night, that involved a man who was very fearful about what was to come in the coming days. One who crosses a stream and spends time alone, reflecting. One who's wrestling with his fears. And one who is visited in his wrestling by an angel. Now, I'm thinking, of course, of the Lord Jesus and those lonely hours he spent in prayer before his trial and crucifixion. So come to John in the New Testament. John chapter 18, verse 1, when Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the Kidron Valley, where there was a garden which he and his disciples entered. So this is a contrast with Jacob. Whereas Jacob kind of sent his 11 sons, as they were, ahead and stays behind himself, Jesus goes across with his sons, doesn't he, effectively? He goes across with his 12. So unlike Jacob then, Jesus puts his brethren at the centre of his life and not on the edge. So that's just kind of a small point. But then come into Luke then, into the account in Luke. Luke chapter 22. And we read what happens there. When he's gone across with his disciples. Verse 40, chapter 22. When he came to the place, he said to them, "Pray that you may not enter into temptation." And he withdrew from them about a stone's throw and knelt down and prayed, saying, "Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done." And there appeared to him an angel from heaven, strengthening him, not weakening him. The difference, again, with Jacob, in Jacob's case, the angel weakened Jacob. Here, the angel strengthens Jesus. And being in an agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. So Jesus is not wrestling against God, is he? He's wrestling with God. They're wrestling together. Against the true enemies of sin and death and fear. That's what they're wrestling against. And so we see Jesus, the heir of Jacob, the heir of the great promises that were made to Jacob, but so much greater than Jacob. God always at the centre of Jesus' life, not on the edge, like he was with Jacob. Jesus and God in harmony in all that they say and all that they do. Unlike Jacob, Jesus was never in the darkness in his life, was he? He was always in the light. And in fact, he was the light for everyone else. He was the light to all men, and he can be our light today. So let us then be a little bit less like Jacob as we go forward in the rest of 2022, and a little bit more like Jesus. Let us put God on the edge of our lives a little bit less, and in the centre of our lives a little bit more. Let us rely more on him and less on ourselves, so that our weakness might become the way in which God works with us in our lives and brings about real change and real strength and real victory. Thank you.
I'd like to thank you very much for those words and bringing us nicely up to the emblems now.